This episode is brought to you by Atlassian. Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Trello help power global collaboration for all teams so they can accomplish everything that's impossible alone. Because individually we're great, but together we're so much better. Learn how to unleash the potential of your team at Atlassian.com. Atlassian.com. Atlassian. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more.
You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Shouldn't you be at work?
It's a lovely chip! Oh, it's a brilliant goal from Lars Boheeden!
Still, it's not away. Southgate's shot. Milosevic scores.
I could do with a bit of magic from him. Maybe this is it. It is! Andy Sinton from nothing.
Brian Roy has headed for his interlead.
And what a goal from Daniel Barkley.
No power on it whatsoever, but Taibbi has made a horrendous error.
Now, you know him better than anybody, probably. Do you back him to score quickly, yes or no?
Yes.
Tony Hassan.
No.
Hello and welcome to Quickly Kevin, Will He Score? It's Series 7, Episode 2. The Jamie Redknapp special is here. I'm Chris Gole and joining me, my co-host Josh Widdicombe.
Hello.
And the man who is so obsessed with the 90s, he still believes Peter Schmeichel is good. It's Michael Marden.
For fuck's sake, hello.
It's astonishing how many goalkeepers we're slaying. I think, I don't want to make big claims, I think we've led to a revision of whether Peter Shilton was good. I think now it's widely considered that Peter Shilton's whole international career is moribund and void because of what we have said about him. And Peter Schmeichel's, I fear, is going the same way.
Not on my watch. Not on my watch.
David Seaman is sweating at home, imagining what we're going to say about him. How have you both been?
Good. I mean, last week was such a week of revelations. The Platy scoring that goal.
Evidence. Hold that there. We will be coming to that. Well, firstly, we want to thank everyone who signed up to the Quickly Kevin Fan Club Patreon. We've had far more people than we'd anticipated. Thank you very much to everyone. We have another. I mean, that was a big, exciting announcement last week. Go to patreon.com/quicklykevin. But we have another exciting announcement. Should we have the same music?
Sunday, 25th of October at 8 p.m. Sunday night extravaganza. Quickly Kevin Live is coming back. Last time we did this, we trended on Twitter.
On Zoom. In your own homes. We have been reading the news. Let's be very clear on that. This isn't in person.
Yes, it will be on Zoom.
Like we're using Zoom like you would use Hoover. It is the brand, but we mean the concept.
Live show, 8 p.m. till 10 p.m. The guests will be Tom Crane and Matt Ford. It will culminate in another big Championship Manager game. And of course, we will be responding live to your correspondence. If you want to join in with the fun, have a look on our social media. There'll be links there to buy a ticket. But you don't have to buy a ticket, Josh, if you're signed up to our Patreon.
If you signed up to your Patreon, all of these Zoom gigs are free. We're planning to do three before Christmas. What we are planning to do here, so we did it before when we had Ellis James against Tom Parry at the height of lockdown, which is both of them choose a team, we interview them, we deal with your correspondence. We trend on Twitter and then we play out Championship Manager game. What we're going to do, we're going to have the ultimate tournament of Championship Manager 97-98 of our favourite Quickly Kevin regulars. Each in turn playing off in four quarterfinals, semis and a final over the coming months. So that is seven Zooms that it will take to get there. The road to Wembley, the road to Zoombly. It doesn't really work, but we'll go with it. So go to the ticket link on our Twitter and our Instagram. Or if you want to go to all of those for free, then you can just sign up at patreon.com/quicklykevin. Chris, shall we have a quick recap of what you get?
Ad-free episodes, exclusive behind the scenes and extra audio visual content, fan club only extended episodes with bonus content, early episode release. Fan club members will get the main series episodes on Saturday afternoon instead of Monday morning. You'll also receive 4 pieces of Quickly Kevin merchandise a year, free tickets to our live Zoom shows, the chance to have your name in the opening titles of the show, early access to live physical show tickets, a free cup of chamomile tea on us. And if all that wasn't enough, each month we will be releasing not one, but 2 extra episodes only for Quickly Kevin Fan Club members. The first one themed episode a month. First up is the return of the Quickly Kevin Film Club, where we review the Robert Duvall and Ally McCoy Scottish football film, A Shot at Glory at Long Last. And finally, the big one, the grand reveal. Each month we are going to do a chapter by chapter reappraisal of the Steve Barnes trilogy in full, with Ivo Graham and the team picking it apart as they go. Yes, you heard us. We are going to pore over every single page of the trilogy of books exclusively for Quickly Kevin Fan Club members. And all of this is available now over on patreon.com/quicklykevin.
Yes, that's right. We do go on about the Steve Bruce aspect, but there is 2 extra episodes a month, not just the Steve Bruce one. But one of our choosing, Chris has a very exciting choice for November the 1st. But this month was Michael's choice. Michael, what did you choose?
I chose the Robert Duvall and Ally McCoy Scottish football movie, A Shot at Glory. And I'm going to say, we did some previous film clubs last series and over lockdown. This is by far my favourite football film we reviewed.
Oh, it's actually a genuinely good film. Should we listen to a bit of it to give them a taste?
Why not?
Here we go. We've had a lot of requests for this. We started doing film clubs during the lockdown, and this is the film we got requested most, which was A Shot at Glory, a film starring the classic duo of Robert Duvall and former European Golden Boot winner Ally McCoy.
And I have to say, looking at the poster of this film, you imagine it's like what an XJ8 catalogue might look like. It is refined, it is luxurious. You've got the big name on there, Duvall. Also Michael Keaton in that kind of void between Batman and his resurgence in Birdman. Also on Wikipedia says Daniel Day-Lewis is in this.
Yeah, that's complete bullshit. Chris, I read the Wikipedia. I went down the cast list. At the bottom, it says Daniel Day-Lewis, and his character name is the one from My Left Foot. And I don't think that...
I was so excited. When I read that, I read that halfway through watching the film, and I was like, it distracted me so much from the film, trying to keep an eye out for Daniel Day-Lewis. Also, he's a master of disguise.
I haven't good authorities, actually, the old tea lady. It's pure method.
4 months he spent working in a football club as a tea lady for that role.
I challenge anyone to watch a film if you're told that somewhere within it, Daniel Day-Lewis might have a surprise cameo. You will not be able to pay attention to what's going on.
I'd say it's a very modern sign of a bad review is I was reading the Wikipedia page halfway through watching it. It's never a good start. But we should say, can we start, sorry, before we get into the film, there's a couple of things I should say. If you want to watch it before listening to this, I don't know how you two watched it. I seem to watch it on Facebook.
Yes, I watched it on Facebook. Did you go in the you go in the comments? Oh, you're in for a treat.
So it was just on Facebook. The full film was on Facebook. I just Googled A Shot of Glory.
Yeah.
One of the first links to come up is someone's just put it on some Facebook group. Yes. The full film.
Wow.
Yes, they did. It was a Rangers fans Facebook group, and people have chipped in when they saw pieces of the film being filmed. So as we go through it, I'll point out what some people commented on.
Someone chipped in, and the worst thing is it went straight over Peter Schmeichel.
Too soon.
Is that purely for the non-Patreon listeners, Michael?
We're going to find out, aren't we? A sort of Inception level Peter Schmeichel jokes within jokes within jokes.
So we should start by if you can go and watch the film and then come back to listen to this. You don't have to. I'm not going to force you. But Michael, should we have the trailer?
Yeah, why not?
the small village of Kilnockie, not much ever changes.
You should try this new invention, Gordon, called a car.
But now...
It is, of course, the recent signing by Kilnockie of Jackie McQuillan.
Scotland's most notorious star soccer player.
But it's McQuillan! Oh, unbelievable!
Has been chosen to boost the town's struggling team.
This guy's going to give us the punch we need, Gordon, to make a run at the cup.
Don't you want to win a cup?
Teams win the cup, Peter. Not prima donnas reminiscing their past glories.
He's brought in enough pain to you.
Is little Jackie's father?
I thought he was out of my life forever.
For God's sake, Dad, you don't have to be stupid.
It was me who had his daughter stolen from him.
Katie!
The truth is that Jackie and Dad are actually more alike than they are different.
Great goal, Jackie!
You say you want to get back together. You can't even pull yourself together.
It will go only as far as our hearts and our lungs will carry us.
This is a real chance for Kilnockie!
Academy Award winner Robert Duvall, Michael Keaton, and introducing Ally McCoist.
They are all driven, stubborn, selfish, and as competitive as a pack of street dogs. Those are probably just the best traits.
This is our shot at glory, lads. All right? All right?
A shot at glory.
It's a good thing, this invention, eh?
That was A Shot at Glory, part of the Quickly Kevin Film Club. There are extra episodes every month over at our Patreon, patreon.com/quicklykevin. We should also say, on the topic of Patreon, you might have heard one of the worst pieces of commentary of all time in the titles. Yeah. That was Chris, because one Patreon member each week will be added to the title, scoring a great goal. We will share the commentary around, or more exciting, we'll try and get professionals, or at least Matt Ford doing an impression of a professional, to put this commentary in. Very excited. Congratulations to Daniel Barkley on your what a goal. Now, is it time for a bit of correspondence?
Come on then.
I'm Jim Rosenthal, and this is the Electronic Postbag.
You've got mail.
Okay. I suppose, should I start with bad news?
Oh, no.
Can we have Lesson Dormer, please, Michael? This is from Chris Payne. Well, I suppose it's good news in that sense, if you saw the David Platt goal as bad news. Hi, I have an update on why David Platt's goal was disallowed.
Ooh.
As discussed on the last episode, and I'm sad to reveal that the goal should have been disallowed. I'm not 100% sure, but I think, I'm not a great start. Oh, I'm not 100% sure. But I think the offside rule in 1990 was different to what it is today. In 1990, if the attacker was in line with the defender when the ball was played, he would be offside, unlike today when he is onside. In 1990, the attacker had to be behind the defender in order to be onside. The rule changed in 1992, along with the back pass rule, to help teams score more goals, which I think we can all agree is finally kicking in at the start of the 2020 season. Chris, how do you feel?
Well, I'd find that a little more believable if a guy called TM Davidson on Twitter hadn't helpfully drawn the lines out, which clearly demonstrated that Platt wasn't even in line. He's comfortably onside.
He's clearly level.
I direct your attention to our Instagram where we've reposted.
I saw it. I saw it, and I'd already received this email, and I thought, oh, there's going to be egg on Chris's face in a few days' time.
I'm just looking at that post now. I can see Michael's liked it. So Michael clearly endorses that he's well onside.
I thought he was offside at the time, and that's just reaffirmed it. The rules were different back then, and even if they weren't, I think it's marginal anyway. The fact that no player contests it, I think...
It is weird about that clip. Like, no one contests it. They take the free kick straight away. But also the weird thing is that the German players kind of stop when the ball's played in. It's a weird goal.
Yeah, well, it's not a goal.
That's why it's so weird.
So, can I cheer you up by playing you something? During the 80s and 90s, there was a selection of adverts from advertising the Cadbury's Boost. These adverts always ended with the same tune. I've attached a link below, which gives you an example. What can fill the Whopper gap? What bites off a crocodile snap? What makes Tina shut her trap? It's new Cadbury's Biscuit Boost. Shot cake biscuit.
biscuit goes down well. The caramel and chocolate tastes real swell. Biscuit boosts a great big bite that tames a giant appetite. Give your snack life.
Okay. Do you remember it?
I remember that advert, yeah.
I don't. I'm not sure.
They transport you back more than anything else, adverts. During this era, my cousin Carl and I were teenagers and were obsessed with 90s football. One day, my cousin and I were sitting in his living room watching TV. One of the adverts came on. As the woman was about to end the advert in a high-pitched melody, my cousin suddenly interjected with his own version. Boost, boost, David, boost.
I kind of guessed it was heading in that direction, but it's lovely to have that confirmed.
For some reason, I found this incredibly hilarious and used to randomly sing this to myself. The problem is, over 25 years later, I still find myself singing this every time I spot a boost bar in a petrol station or a corner shop. So if you're not excited enough for that, here's the next sentence. Here is a voice clip of my version.
Boost, boost, David, boost.
Again, please play again.
Okay, here it comes.
Boost, boost, David, boost.
Oh my God. Do you know what? That has done me for life now. That is going to do me for life. I'm never going to see a boost bar. I never think, boost, boost, David, boost.
You've gone up an octave, Chris.
You're trying to harmonise.
I'm not going to be able to see a boost now. I think now if you go into a petrol station and you see a boost, if you're a Quickly Kevin listener, you should say that out loud to see if there are other Quickly Kevin listeners about.
You know how Cadbury do those sort of quite irreverent left field adverts? Yeah. If any ad exec is listening, I reckon you could see a real spike in boost numbers if you got the real David Boost to promote boost. It won't make sense to 99.9% of the population, but you'd inherit some diehard fans.
My brother-in-law works at Cadbury. Is that a boost brand? This could actually happen. Yeah. Think how happy David Boost would be to be associated with something other than a horrific leg break.
Do you know also who I blame for that injury? Mr. Peter Schmeichel. Anyway, we haven't finished. He said, I thought I'd share this with you for two reasons. Number one, you're probably the only people who appreciate it. And secondly, it's another Coventry City connection to add to the snow. And I know this will please the listener who accused the show of being very stingy on the Coventry City front. Have a wonderful day, Scott Brannan.
Oh, thank you, Scott. That's really tickled me.
Okay. This is from Matthew Pont. Hello, love the podcast. We listen to them all the time. Thank you very much, Matthew. I've done some detective work on your suspicions that Terry Smith, ex-Chester City manager and owner, edited his own Wikipedia page.
Oh, yes, please.
Oh, I forgot about this.
And I show my findings below. So it's Terry Smith's Wikipedia page, which we said was edited. So he's copied and pasted. Now, I haven't got the technical ability to ever get to this point, but you can go in and see where all the edits are done, can't you? And when and
yeah.
stuff.
Yeah.
So he's copy and pasted this, but he's talked us through it. We'll put this up. We'll put a screen grab of this up on our Instagram. We can see on the edit page that a lot of the edits were made by the following IP address, and then he's put it, on March 2018, which was 9 months before the Quickly Kevin episode aired. You can do a search on the IP address, basically a unique number given to every online computer in the world, here. And we can see that this is the IP address of Johnson City in Tennessee. My suspicions were aroused. He's then attached a map. What we'll do, we'll put this on Instagram as one of those things you can flick through all the different pictures. So next thing to do is a quick Google for Terry Smith, Johnson City, to find out this is either a big Terry Smith fan like myself or the man himself. The Google search, thankfully, came up with a list of candidates, and the prime suspect is this one, Terry Michael Smith, age 60s. This is almost certainly the real Terry Smith. It matches the info on his Wikipedia page, age 61, wife Sarah, daughter Shannon, full name Terry Michael Smith. So, with this proof, I conclude that Terry Michael Smith of Johnson City, Tennessee, did in fact edit his own Wikipedia page on March 2018.
Wow. I love that. I got nothing but respect for that.
That is super. That's exactly the kind of support we're looking for from our listeners, i.e. the kind of people that record the boost advert or go down what can only be described as a Wikipedia wormhole.
Yeah. Sort of terrifying the digital fingerprint that you leave as well.
Yes. We should start a feature on famous footballers or 90s figures in general that you think have edited their own Wikipedia pages. If you've seen any, please send in your examples of them.
Do you know what? And as well, if we were to launch an investigation, maybe we could call it the Terry Cook Report.
Oh,
lovely.
Lovely. So the Terry Cook Report will be coming your way in the following week.
Do you know what? Let's not limit it to Wikipedia. If you want to get the Quickly Kevin hive mind to investigate something in particular, obviously not legal, fairly flippant, like Terry Smith's Wikipedia,
yeah,
then let us know. We'll send the Terry Cook report in.
We'll send the Terry Cook report in.
I'd love the hive mind to create a supercut of Peter Schmeichel saving attempts at him getting chipped.
they're not miracle workers, Michael. If anyone is good at CGI, then do let Michael know.
Right, footballers' diets. Hi, guys. Love the podcast. I was just catching up with the Manchester United documentary episode, and the mention of baked beans got my memory going. In school, my friend's dad was the England football team head chef throughout the 90s. I remember in preparation for France 98 being round his house when a large shipment of food was delivered. There were industrial amounts of baked beans, along with mountains of tomato ketchup, and to my surprise, crate after crate of strawberry and banana Yazoo.
I mean, that stuff is so bad for you.
The milkshake.
I was amazed to see this, but apparently every player was given a Yazoo after training to boost up their energy levels.
What?
That is crazy. It's like, I remember in the 90s, in the 80s and 90s, were you ever given Lucozade as a kid as if it was medicine?
Yeah. I was having this conversation. Remember, it used to be in pharmacies, and that's what really kind of made me think it was like pharmaceutical in some regard.
You've got to remember what it did to John Barnes after 90 minutes of sheer hell. Thank you to Dan for that food email.
See, the more you hear about France 98, the more of a shambles it seems. Everyone talks about Eileen Drury, but what about the fact that the players were clearly shoved down one end of the bus while there's like crates of baked beans down the team bus and like strawberry and banana Yazoo taking up the aisle? No good, Glenn.
I mean, you'd think Glenn Hoddle would be quite a progressive guy.
Maybe that was the secret to his managerial kind of triumphs in the early 90s. Everyone was off their tits on the Yazoo.
If you want to get in touch, this is how.
Get in touch with the show. Email hello@quicklykevin.com. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter @quicklykevin. And sign up to the mailing list @quicklykevin.com.
Okay, now, this was such a success last week that we had to bring it back. It is, of course...
Was it?
Come on, mate. Chandler's Island Dish has smashed it. Well, anyway, whether it's a success or not, I'll leave that up to you. But here it is. It's the 90s o'clock news. Jamie Marino's coat on eBay, maybe. Paul Merson furious at Gunnosaurus' departure. First bit of news. Helpfully, a listener, after last week, we mentioned that Jamie Marino was spotted in a Teesside 10-pin bowling alley with a Man of the Match Coca-Cola Cup 94-95 bomber jacket, match-worn. And that match-worn jacket has turned up. No, it's not match-worn, is it? But he's worn it after the match. But it's turned up on eBay for only £20. And... reading the description, it could be Jamie Marino's.
It could be.
It's the same season. It looks similar, and it says in the description that it's been hung in a bar for many years.
Yes.
So that, I mean, it adds up.
Presumably, they're getting them every. You know, there must have been loads of these jackets.
Hence, it only 94-95.
Well, yeah, because there's like loads of League Cup games, and there's a Man of Match in each of them, Chris.
They're turning out jackets. I thought it was just for the TV ones. They're turning out jackets for every game.
They can't be, can they? Am I mad?
Joe, there is a wonderful detail to this. Obviously, that shot of Marino
with the stitching around the collar.
You only saw the front, but the back has a massive Coca-Cola Cup embroidered football. It really reminiscent of Alan Partridge's Castrol GTX jacket.
Yeah, it really
it's
is.
Enormous. So if that could be your, I know, Michael, you're thinking about bidding on this, but if a listener's interested, you just need to type into eBay, actual player match worn issued Man of the Match Coca-Cola Cup Liverpool.
Well, I have, when you sent that through, I immediately put a bid in on it. And I didn't know you were going to use it as a feature for 90s O'Clock News. So now I'm worried I'm going to get trapped in a bidding war with like 50,000 Quickly Kevin people. So this episode goes out on Saturday for our Patreon members, early release, and Monday for our main ones. I'm going to try and secure that jacket before those episodes go out.
Do you know what? I think the auction closes before this episode goes out. I think so. You might be in luck there.
Well, that first Zoom live show, we'll see if I'm wearing that jacket or not, won't we?
How excited. And secondly, on the 90s o'clock news, big news story last week, Gunnosaurus departing Arsenal after 27 years of service.
Times.
Paul Merson fuming about it on Sky Sports. And there's one thing he said in particular that I thought was worth pointing out. He said, Gunnosaurus, it's a weird interview. It's on Sky Sports. Do Google it if you haven't seen it. He said, he's on about 80 grand a week, Gunnosaurus. And he keeps saying it, but he said a week.
What? A week?
But he sounded like it's not a joke. It's like, I don't know if he's got, he thinks he's saying a year, but he's saying a week. And it doesn't appear like he's joking. But then he goes on to say, think about all those junior gunners. He's a part of it now. There'll be 30 and 40-year-old fans who grew up with that dinosaur. Grew up with that dinosaur.
It was very sad. But did you see Mesut Ozil paid for his wages? I do worry about Pilgrim Pete now. But I don't think he's on 80 grand a year, because that would make him paid similar to some of our lesser paid players, I imagine. So, well, there we go.
That's it for the 90s o'clock news. If you spot something, do email in hello@quicklykevin.com.
Now, so excited to get this man on. It's our first member of the Liverpool team in the 90s, something we've always wanted to have. And let's be honest, you couldn't choose a better one, either as a footballer or as a man. It is the wonderful, the peerless Jamie Redknapp.
Molby. Little triangle working nicely. McManaman. There's no offside. There's a real chance, and it's taken by Jamie Redknapp.
Our guest this week continues to be one of the most iconic figures of 90s football. Among the first of a new generation of Premier League pop culture celebrities, he combined silky skills with impossibly photogenic good looks. One of the most technically gifted players of his generation, he brought the Kop to its feet on dozens of occasions in the middle of a mid-90s Liverpool team known for their flair, both on and off the pitch. It's our pleasure to welcome to Quickly Kevin, Jamie Redknapp.
Someone else in other someone
else. How does that feel, Jamie? Sum you up.
It feels nice. It feels nice, Widders. Thank you for having me on. You and I have spoken about doing this a long time, and I'm really pleased we finally made it happen. So, yeah, 90s football. It's brings back some great memories.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's your memory like just before we get into it? Are you still cognizant? You remember it all?
Yeah, pretty good. There's probably not less nights out, but more matches I'm good on.
Now, I should say, you have got something next to you, which you've just brought up with me, is the first copy of your book.
Do you know what? Funny enough, this came hot off the press this morning. Yeah, it's going to be fun because it is a bit about 90s football, really, because it just goes up to, it finishes actually on me making my Liverpool debut.
Oh, yeah.
So a lot of great memories, you know, signing for Liverpool as a 17-year-old, and it interjects with some of the like legends at Liverpool, like Kenny Dalglish has a section in it, John Barnes, obviously my dad, Frank Lampard. So yeah, it was really good fun to make it. And at a time when we're doing this, it's brought back a lot of great memories.
Yeah, I bet. And have you got a pair of Skechers trainers you want to show us as well, Jamie?
I've not got the Skechers on today, mate.
Let's go back to those first, when you were a kid. So were you always amazing at football from the off?
Oh, you know what, mate? That's a hard question. I'm sure, my dad always said, actually in this book, he knew from the age of 3 or 4 years of age that I was going to be a footballer. He said, it's just the way you passed the ball, the way you moved. He said, yeah, you were just, and you loved the game. You know, and the thing about it is, and it's the same for all of us, I think to do something and to try to be successful at it, you've got to have like a passion and an obsession. Ooh. And I have always been obsessed with football. There's not a day that goes by without it being part of my life. I dream about it every single night, and sometimes nightmares about it. But it's just always in my mind, football, and talking about it. My kids play it. And it's been so good for me as well.
We talked about your family. Your dad, Harry Redknapp, played football. Your uncle, Frank Lampard Sr., big West Ham legend. Your cousin, Frank Lampard Jr. And your brother, Mark, played a bit as well. So we were saying, like, back garden games growing up, that must be a really high standard. Was there ever a game where you were all playing?
Yeah, always. I mean, as a kid, my granddad was a really talented player. An argument to say probably the most talented out of all of us. His name was Harry Senior, and we used to go down to they had a caravan down in the Isle of Sheppey. So we used to go down to the Isle of Sheppey every summer during the school holidays and spend 6 weeks down there. You know, my nan and granddad, and he would just start. Kids from all around the campsite would come to his caravan, come to see us, and say, "Right, Harry, what time's the game today?" All of a sudden, a game would start with like 8-a-side, 9-a-side, end up being 20-a-side. And I'm 8, 9 years of age. Kids everywhere. Frank Senior would come down with Frank Junior, who's obviously a little bit younger at the time. My dad would join him. Kids from all different campsites, our campsite against another one. But that was what it was. And it just, you know, football was always such a big part of my life. And when Frank Jr. used to come down in the summers with his family, we'd be out in the garden all day, non-stop, really? Practicing, playing, because there are no shortcuts. I'm not trying to preach to people, but if you want to be a footballer, there's not a footballer that we watch on TV. They might make out they didn't do a lot. Robbie Fowler might actually be one of the only ones that just had that natural talent and didn't need to train that much. But most of them are putting the hard yards when everyone else was indoors or in the dressing rooms getting showered.
And when I think you told me before that you go to Bournemouth training instead of going to school. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, it does sound a little bit bizarre to people, but my dad, one of my friends, we were talking about it, and he worked out, I think, so I missed 48 days in a year once. I mean, it's terrible. 48, imagine that. I mean, but it's a wonder I can't read or write.
Was your mum not annoyed?
Mum didn't know. A lot of the time, we used to get in the car and we'd be my dad's timekeeping isn't the best, and we'd get in the car and he'd go, "Look, you know, we're running a bit late. Do you want to just come training today?" And I'd be like, go on then. You know, one of those. I mean, who didn't want to go and do maths with Mr. Tchaikovsky when you go play football at Bournemouth? You know what I mean? It was like one of those. So it was. I was so lucky. But I'd go. And I'd either join him at 11, 12 years of age with the first team. And my dad would like, "Let me join in." And it made me sort of, it certainly, although I don't look at it now, and I don't know if my dad subconsciously thought I'm making a footballer, but it went a long way that helped me become a footballer, because I knew that if I trained and I gave the ball away, it ruined the session. So that was so influential in me. Wanting to give the ball away. And even if I just had to spend all day getting the ball to the players or just picking up the kit, I didn't care. I just wanted to be around football. I wanted to be a footballer. And it was just so much part of my life.
I think you picked up some injuries at the end of your career. Is that because you were training with the first team of Bournemouth at 11 years old? That can't be good for the knee.
Do you know what? Joking aside, because I do, you know, obviously the injuries play a big part. And I know Josh and I, we do League of Their Own together, and I get a lot of stick for it. But I do look back, and I do wonder sometimes. I remember the amount I played as a kid, and I play on Saturday, I play in the morning, I play in the afternoon, I trained all the time. I probably did too much as a kid, and there is an argument to say that's why I did, because all my injuries, I didn't have like a little muscle injury. Like I broke my ankle twice. I had about 15 knee operations. So they weren't little injuries. They were injuries, obviously, when I was developing and growing. And maybe I did too much. So there does come like another side to it. But there's nothing you can do about that. I don't look back and go, what if? So I had I was so lucky to have done what I did, play for Liverpool and England, and had the most amazing laugh and times doing it.
And as well, I think people might suspect that you had a really privileged upbringing. But you know, back when you were a kid, Harry was still a manager at Bournemouth. He didn't have all this Premier League success he got later in his career. Your mum worked in a hairdresser's. You had a £3.70 a week paper round, I read. And that you used to, if other kids didn't turn up, you'd have to do their paper round. But if that happened, you would wake your dad up and he would drive you around and get you to hit and help you out on your paper round.
Yeah, I was a spare boy, I think that's what they called me. But I did, I know, because when dad was a player, obviously we all think about, we just imagine footballers earning vast amounts of money forever. It wasn't the case. When my dad retired, he had no money. He liked to bet, so I'm sure he got rid of a lot of that gambling as well. So he then managed Oxford City, funny enough, with Bobby Moore, not Oxford United, Oxford City, which is a non-league team, and they used to travel up there all the time, and that didn't really work out. Then we went over to America, we went to a cup, he coached in Seattle, coached in Arizona, that didn't really work out either. Ends up coming back to Bournemouth, and I'm not just saying it, we had nothing. I went to, obviously a normal comprehensive school. I was treated like, it's easy to say now, but I never, although my mum and dad, we weren't poor, But my dad worked hard and, you know, got me everything that I could. It was the best boots that I could possibly have. But I also had to do it because that's why I had the paper round, because he wanted me to establish, you know, good morals, make sure I worked hard for everything I get. And that's something that really, you know, I've adhered to all my life. I think if you work hard, you know, you get rewarded. So I was very fortunate that my dad did well at an age. As I got older, when he became obviously manager of Bournemouth, things started to change, and then we went from one house to another, and all of a sudden then he built a house. It was like, wow, I couldn't believe it. No, it was amazing. So no, but he's worked hard and he deserves everything he gets.
Did you and then you signed for Bournemouth? So how does that come about? Does your dad take your side and say, I'm gonna sign you?
I'll tell you exactly how it happened, Josh. I was at Tottenham. So when I signed for Tottenham at 14 till I was 21, which was obviously a contract that you probably was to a certain extent a little bit, but a lot of players did it then because I was at Everton as a kid. I was at West Ham, Tottenham, and then I decided to sign for Tottenham at 14. They gave me a long contract, 2-year apprenticeship, 2-year pro. But then when I got to 16, I just didn't see a pathway for me. I saw a lot of good reserve team players that were stuck, if you like, and Bournemouth at the time were signing lots of players. So I went to see Terry Venables with my dad and I said, look, you know, I love Tottenham, but I feel a bit homesick and I don't think I'm ready to come to Tottenham right now. I mean, I moved to Liverpool a year later, so that didn't really work out. You know, but at the time, it felt a really good lie. And so then I said to Dad, like, I think I can get in your first team, and I could then, if in a year's time, hopefully I can go to a first team. But I want to get some first team experience. I can be in your first team at 16 years of age, which really,
it's a brave decision.
Brave, yeah, because like kids that were, I went to be an apprenticeship with Bournemouth that were. They were like, you're mad. You've got the security at Tottenham till you're 21, and Bournemouth are giving you a 1-year deal. But it was, you know. It was almost like bullseye. You just gamble. I just thought, right, yeah. I'm going to gamble. I can do it. I've got it in me. I know what I'm capable of. And I got into Bournemouth first team. I made my debut at 16. And they had really good people. Like, obviously, I was lucky to have my dad as a manager. Like, Tony Pulis was there. Ian Bishop was a really good midfield player. Played for West Ham. You guys will know Bish. So, Sean Brooks was a tremendous midfield player. So people I could get a lot of what Tony Pulis would ingrain in me, in the hard work, determination, like a nastiness, if you like. And Sean Brooks and the other players had the skill and the guile. So I thought I could learn more there rather than playing in Tottenham's youth team. And it was one of the best decisions I've ever made.
Yeah.
But were you doing the YTS stuff, like sweeping up the dressing room and washing boots? Would your dad make you do that?
Your best time of my football career, without a doubt, with your mates. You know, a lot of my best, I'm still good friends with them now. And there's one of the, Dave Morris was... a midfield player, so Dave Morris and a guy called Dean Giddings. Both, they didn't make it professionally, but they're good. They had, you know, played non-league and very talented boys. But they were my best mates. So we, you know, we'd train all day, and then we'd get jobs to John, a guy called John Kirk, captain. He was like in charge. He was the foreman, so he used to give us all jobs. You had to clean the toilets. You had to paint the stands. You had to do everyone's boots. I had to clean Luther Blissett's and Sean Brooks's boots. It was all just part of it, and it was. Do you know what? It was the best part of it. Because you were with your mates, you know, you're 16 years of age, you've got £27 a week, but you felt like you were millionaires. And that Saturday night, you go in, you know, you have your fake ID, and you try to get in Madison's nightclub if you were lucky. I always used to forget my ID, and I'd give 1973, and, you know, instead of 72 or 71, you know what I mean?
Did you negotiate your contract with your dad? Was that a tough negotiation?
Yeah, I've got it. Do you know what? I've got it. I'm going to read it to you. I've got it here somewhere. Hold on. So when I signed my initial contract at Bournemouth, I think the terms were I got a £5,000 signing on fee.
Oh, it's good money.
Yeah. So, I mean, that at the time. Oh, here we go. So I've got it here. So, yeah, so I was getting to my basic wage in 1990 for the 30. I'm going to be paid £130 a week. And plus, I got £100 for every appearance in the first team. The play, and then I got a once and only signing on fee of £5,000.
That's good money, though, for a 16-year-old.
I know. Well, it actually got. Let's have a look with us. It got better because if we won the FA Cup, there was more chance of flying to the moon. We got $8,000. I mean, it was $8 million, man.
That'll incentivise you to win the FA Cup for Bournemouth.
No.
If only they'd made it 10.
I didn't care. I was, you know, it made no difference if you were getting that or whatever it was. But that was part of money. I didn't play football to think, and I'm not, this is not a dig at modern day football, but nowadays you players, you know, it's all the trappings that go with it, the nice cars, everything else, and you know, the houses, the cars, the clothes, the watches. When we were that age, I just wanted to be a footballer. I just wanted to play for AFC Bournemouth and put that kit on. And that was all that mattered.
Were you living with your dad while he was your manager?
Yeah, of course. I was 16. What do you think? I'm going to go out and live on my own. Why would I? My mum's a great cook.
And so were you like going home and was he picking you in the team or was that causing problems around the dinner table or like...
It was difficult. There was a few times when my mum would come in and go, "You playing tomorrow?" And I'd go, "Nah, mum, he's not. He's not picked me. Oh, that bastard." So then I'd like go, "All right, mum, you know, don't worry, mum, it's all right." And then she'd like, they'd have a couple of potatoes. I'd have loads. And it was fine. But you know what? He was protecting me. I played, you know, but he also. He knew what he was doing. He knew that once I got into the first team, I think I only started 13 games for him. Kenny Dalglish then called him. He met my dad at a dinner. It was a sports writer's dinner or something like that. And went up to my dad and said, "I've heard a lot about your boy. You know, I'd love to sign him." And then, an enormous amount of confidence. Dad came back and told me that night. I remember him waking me up and said, "Look, you know, Kenny Dalglish spoke to me and they want to sign you." Wow, I couldn't believe it. But I was adamant. I said, "Look, Dad, this is fine. You know, they want me to go up there and speak to them." And I've gone, "I want to go there, but I'm not ready yet. I want to play in your first team. I want to establish myself." And it meant a lot to me. I didn't want to go to Liverpool like everyone else. I wanted to have had some kind of first team experience, and it certainly helped me.
So you didn't go straight away. It was a few months after that first contact.
No. I tell you what I did exactly. I went up to... I'm not going to call it a trial because they wanted me. So they just asked me to go and train. I went up there and stayed with Kenny and his family. And I went up there for a week because I was in Bournemouth's first team at the time. I went up and it was just, I couldn't believe it. You know, you got on the bus with all these first team players. I've got John Barnes on my wall in my bedroom. And next thing I'm sitting next to him and it's like, wow. And, you know, just...
What was Barnes like when you signed?
You know, they always say, "Josh, don't meet your heroes," but it was just, he was amazing to me. Because my first day is when I actually signed at Liverpool. So in those days that you used to go, nowadays the players would get in the car, go to the training ground. But in the Shankly days, the boot room days, you used to get on the bus. So you'd get on the bus, and this old rickety bus, you'd be at Anfield, you'd get changed, and then Ronnie Moran used to shout this, I think it was like "Away the New." So I remember my first day thinking, what's that mean? Anyway, everyone then gets up. You walk back up the tunnel, back out, and then there's a bus waiting for you that's like, it's the oldest bus you've ever seen. It's not like a really nice one that you want to get on. Anyway, I get on. So I walk up. Most of the first team are on there first because they come in a slightly quicker direction. I'm in the reserve team dressing room. So John Barnes is sitting there and Ronnie Whelan. As I'm walking up, I'm just clocking him, Alan Hansen, and I'm like blowing my mind. These are my heroes. So I go and sit down next to someone. They go, "Can't sit there, son. That's Ronnie Whelan's seat." And I go, "Okay." So I get up, go to the next seat on the bus. "You can't sit there. That's Steve McMahon's seat." "Oh, okay, no problem." Anyway, Alan Hansen's seat. They've got me. I'm all over the place. Now I can feel it's freezing cold. I can feel the beads of sweat coming down my face. Johnny Barnes went, "Come and sit here, mate." Anyway, I went and sat next to Johnny, and he just went, "Don't worry about them. You're going to get plenty of that." Because I think, because I was a southerner, and he was a southerner himself. He'd been through it. Although he signed, obviously, when he was a bit more established than I was. But I had the long hair, and he was like, "Oh, you've got that some long hair there." I think he was questioning me a little bit. But it was great.
Well, you signed on the 15th of January 1991. A month later, Kenny leaves, and in comes Graeme Souness. And then suddenly you're in the middle of a big news story, and everything's changing. You signed for Dalglish, and now you've got Souness.
Yeah, it was mad. I mean, because the first week I signed, Kenny actually put me on the bench against Wimbledon.
Oh, wow.
So I signed on the... So I think that was a Thursday I signed. Anyway, on the Friday, I trained with the first team. And then Kenny said to me, come and stay at my house that night, and you know, with the marina and the kids. And I end up staying in the house.
Kelly Cates there.
You're gonna, yeah. I stayed in Kelly's bed. She wasn't there. He wasn't there. And Kelly, they get Kelly out into another room. I'm staying in Kelly's bed. And then, so the next morning, Kenny's taking me to the game, and we're at Anfield. And so Kenny reads out the team. in those days, two subs. So, I'm still in this awe of what's going on around me, in awe of everyone. And then he names the team, names the subs. So I just get up, and as I'm just going to walk out the dressing room, everyone starts coming up to me and going, like, congratulations. I'm like, what? They go, you're sub. I'm like, no, I'm not. I just hear that. I went, I couldn't take my eyes off John Barnes. Anyway, it works out I was a sub. But unfortunately, I didn't get on because of it was one all that game. John Barnes scored and Warren Barton scored about 20 minutes to go. So Kenny was probably just a little bit protected. Then a week later, he leaves. And it was like, I couldn't believe it. I've got to be honest. I was gutted. But, you know, he actually called me, which was probably the nicest thing anyone's ever done in football. Because when he left, it was one of the biggest, you know, it was the most incredible thing. It was like, you remember where you were when Kenny left Liverpool. And it obviously had a lot of problems. And I fully understood it. And having had a dad in management, I probably understood it fully more than anyone. But then I went back to my digs. I'm staying with a lady called Mrs. Sainsbury. The phone goes, I'm devastated. Anyway, it's Kenny. Just to say, look, Jamie, I just want to just say what's happened today. You're always going to be fine at Liverpool. You know, we've got so much respect for you. You're going to be a great player. Look, tomorrow, I know you haven't travelled with the first team, but tomorrow I'm playing golf at Hillside, which is his course. He said, let's go and have 18 holes together after training and we'll have a good chat. And I'm thinking, this guy is going through probably absolute hell in his mind. He's left the biggest job in football and he still had the time to call me. And it just tells you every single thing you need to know about the man.
Yeah. I don't know anyone that doesn't... people speak so well of him, don't they? He's just... such kind of inspiring guy.
He went through so much at Liverpool. People forget. You know, he went to, I think, every single funeral.
Yeah.
You know, for all those people at Hillsborough. And you can imagine he was in a... nothing compared to the families who lost their loved ones. But that sense of togetherness and Kenny putting himself out to go to every funeral, to just help the families that little, just to try to make it as easy as possible. And it only, I don't know how many years ago he got a knighthood, but there's people getting knighthoods for things, you know, or honours from the Queen. Kenny only got one a year or two ago for his services and what he's done to football.
I mean,
it's just incredible that it took so long for people to acknowledge what he did.
Maybe a less celebrated Liverpool managerial reign came next under Graham Souness, and obviously got a reputation as a strict disciplinarian, very intimidating man. I heard a story that he used to do topless press-ups in front of the first team just to kind of intimidate you and bring a bit more out of you. Is that true?
He did. That's the first time. Yeah, he loved it. He couldn't wait to get his top. But the first time he did it, he's just after he had his heart bypass. So he walked in and he's got a scar all the way down here. And he just got out and just like polished off a quick like 25 press ups and just got up, just like sweat glistening. And it was like, you know, one of them. You know what I mean? Like, what do you say? What do you say to that? Graham Souness is in front of you doing topless press ups.
Was he a scary, like, so when he arrives, what was he like? I know obviously now you kind of, but
I'm still scared.
To do topless press ups before you go on air.
On Super Sunday.
What was he like when he came in then? Did he like have that fear factor completely?
Yeah, absolutely. Everyone was scared stiff of him because of his history. Of what he'd done at the club. He was one of the best midfield players the club's ever seen. So, yeah, I think there was a bit of a fear factor involved with Graham. And I think he'd tell you himself, I don't need to talk out of turn. Graham tried to change things too quickly. And you had the old guard there of players that were just coming to the end. He was trying to bring through the likes of Robbie, myself. Steve McManaman was a brilliant player, Macca. And then the old players, it's like you had to do things gradually. He wanted to get rid of that boot room. He wanted to get the story I told about the bus. He didn't want that. So he wanted to turn things into the modern era. A lot of fans didn't want that. A lot of ex-players didn't like it. And it didn't work out for Graham as a manager. It's a shame because I think he could have been brilliant for the club.
I mean, was it,
but these things happen.
Is it a big ask, isn't it? That old guard, they really ruled the roost, as you experienced on the bus, and those amazing young players coming through. It's a tough job for anybody, isn't it?
Yeah, because, and also the greats were coming to the end. You know, that McMahon and Whelan and Stevie Nicol that had been so good for the club were just starting to get maybe slightly older, and they were brilliant players and great characters. So Graham realised he had to change things, but it had to be done gradually and maybe did it a little bit too quickly. But I mean, he gave me my debut. I was, you know, he gave my debut at 18 years of age playing against Auxerre. He gave me my Premier League, or actually League Division One debut at the time. So I owe Graham an enormous amount of, you know, gratitude because of what he did for me.
He got quite, you know, there was elements of, he brought in Julian Dix, there was Neil Ruddock, there was kind of hard man. He liked a hard player, like a kind of tough players.
I think that's why we got on so well.
Saw a lot of him.
I like the way you laugh. So you look, laugh. I promised if I played now, I would be a modern day king. I'm telling you, you think it's funny.
That was the first half of Jamie Redknapp, who had so much good stuff to say that we have split it into two. So if you want to listen to the second half, it's there waiting for you where you listen to your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.